Greetings and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm your host, Monica Black. As you know, we pick exciting new books that the world needs to know about, and we interview their authors. And today we are talking to Sean Forner, Associate Professor of History at Michigan State University. Sean has just published a very exciting new book called German Intellectuals and the Challenge of Democratic Renewal, Culture and Politics After 1945. The book was just published at the very tail end of last year by Cambridge University Press. So without further ado, Sean, how are you? How's the weather in East Lansing?
Hi, Monica. I'm doing well. Thanks very much for asking. And I'm inside, so I'm not subject to the, it's cold here. It's cold, but it's super bright, which is one of the nice things that can happen in an upper Midwest winter.
Got yeah, a lot absolutely. Of sun today. That's right. You get those brilliant blue skies.
Well, on rare occasion in Michigan, rarer than Minnesota where I'm from, but it's nice today.
Right. Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. It's not very nice where I am, but...
I was just going to ask.
I wonder if you want to get us started by telling us something about yourself and sort of introducing yourself to our listeners.
I'm a professor, recently associate professor, I guess I should say, at Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. I'm a historian of 20th century Europe and of Germany, and I'm especially curious in my research about intersections of intellectual history and political culture, about how imaginations about politics and society are shaped in time and in place. I teach a wide range of courses, undergraduate and graduate, chiefly on modern European history here at MSU. So from lower level surveys on things like the European Union to a graduate seminar on historiography and social theory. I did my PhD at the University of Chicago. Actually, I've spent much of my life in the Midwest, as I've already hinted at. Mm-hmm. I did grow up in Minnesota, where the skies are much brighter and blue in the winter than they too often are here in mid-Michigan. I grew up in a family, a German-American family, with a German mother and an American father. It's not actually something that I identified with strongly as a child, but I'm sure it's not irrelevant to the direction that my later interests have taken.
Yeah, it's always interesting how things that didn't strike you particularly when you were young about your biography later seem to gain meanings that they didn't have, you know, depending on sort of how the course of your life tends to go. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about German intellectuals and the challenge of democratic renewal, because, of course, there was certainly a challenge to the notion of democratic renewal in 1945 in defeated Germany. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you came to the project and what your sort of initial interest was in the figures, these very interesting figures whose sort of careers you develop in the post-war period over the course of your book.
My initial interest, developed over the course of my studies, course in history and in philosophy and literature, and on the historical side, I guess, fascination that brings many of us to German history with the upheavals that Germany both experienced and caused in the world. Of course, my interest in German contributions to Europe's philosophical and literary traditions, informed then this curiosity about how these matters converged after 1945 in just the sort of respects that you're gesturing at. I mean, there was a challenge with democratic renewal in this moment. In many ways, my what I was curious about was first to think about how the various challenges, my actors talk and think a lot about democracy, but of course, the question of culture, the question of guilt, the question of responsibility, the question of traditions and their fates loomed so large for intellectuals and for other folks in this moment. I think a lot of the attention, like many people in the field, I cut my teeth on sort of the great thinkers of the emigration in this respect, mainly exiled people like Hannah Arendt or the thinkers of the so-called Frankfurt School. But as I approached my dissertation from that sort of perspective, I wondered more about a broader field of intellectuals and their activities, and especially about the devastated ground of post-Nazi Germany itself, of how questions about German history and modernity and recovery from this set of catastrophes might look from their epicenter, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It certainly does make sense. I mean, of course, you know, you're speaking to a fellow German historian, so these questions and the sort of issues of guilt and of how to relate now to the past and all those things that are so wonderfully revealed in your book are things that, you know, we think about quite a lot, particularly those of us who focus on the period after 1945. I wonder if maybe a way that we can get that we can start to sort of get more deeply into the matter of your book is by talking about this sort of amazing cast of characters with whom you deal in the book. Your characters are a group of mostly men, I think, whom you call engaged Democrats. And I wonder if you could tell us what you mean by this is a terminology of your own construction, engaged Democrats. I wonder if you could tell us who engaged Democrats were. And, you know, who were they sort of sociologically, ideologically, politically, et cetera? And why do they become, in your book, such a crucial force for the reconstruction or, let's say, the rehabilitation of a democratic ideal in the wasteland of post-war Germany?
Yes, that's exactly right. This is the term that I use to talk about this. You know, fairly large, but necessarily so for my purposes, group of actors that are at the center of my story, 10 to 15, maybe they're at the very center, and then a broader field of, you know, 30 or more. It's a group that emerged into my view analytically as I asked myself these questions about post-Nazi Germany, which, of course, as you've mentioned in some senses are very classic or even conventional questions, right, about Germany's democratization after National Socialism. You know, it's definitely not an unconventional set of questions. But I really wanted to focus on this immediate post-war period. What was the shape of the memory of the recent past, of National Socialism, of war, of Holocaust, in the immediate wake of these events? What sorts of debates emerged about moving forward in politics and in the economy and culture, and also how were these inflected by the pressures of the Cold War, by Germany's occupation through the four victorious powers of the then not yet disintegrated Grand Alliance, and then by of course the incipient division as those tensions among the victors took shape, and the polarization of the world began to unfold. And I guess that the engaged Democrats were a way for me to name a group of actors who, these are public intellectuals. They kind of exploded onto the scene in the late 1940s under these very peculiar conditions and had a debate about democratic renewal, or shaped a larger public debate about democratic renewal. And they shared a set of concerns, a shared sense of the challenges that they confronted, and a shared sense of what kinds of answers might be adequate or appropriate in that context. And this was a way for me to group these actors together. It's technically not my coinage in a sense. It's something I adapted from two German scholars that use it in a kind of related, but a more limited register. And I guess as you were saying, engaged Democrats, I'm reminded of a lot of conversations I've had about the term. It can sound very celebratory in many respects. I suppose it is. And we all have certain kinds of interests and investments in the stories that we tell and the actors that we tell stories about. I certainly have mine in this book, and it had something to do with things that I appreciated about what these actors were doing and saying. But I intended it really as descriptive, as a term that captures two common denominators to this really rather loose and diverse group, a commitment to public intervention, so engagement in that sense, you know, also responding to a very clear sense of the malleability of this present moment, that in the wake of the destruction, in the wake of what they also referred to as the catastrophe that had just passed in post-Nazi defeated Germany, the kinds of influence that they might have by intervening publicly in discussions about what form a future Germany should take. And then also in terms of the content of their of what they talked about, right? And when they used the word as well as when they didn't use the word, what I found them talking a lot about was democracy, was the question of popular rule, of who are the people and what might constitute the people ruling, and how this might be an answer to Germany's post-fascist predicament. And this, the way that they developed of talking and thinking about it, and some of the ways that they developed of acting in the public arena, had an emphatically participatory sort of inflection to it, is one of my main claims. So engaged in that sense too, that it draw it, their various kinds of proposals and ideas hinged really on the engagement, on the active involvement of the people themselves. So an engaged group of actors and an engaged sense of democracy, this engaged Democrats term is supposed to capture.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that that's exactly what happens in the book. I wonder if you can tell us, maybe I hadn't thought about asking you this, but listening to what you said about, I liked what you said about how, you know, all historians, all scholars, all of us generally have commitments in life that are very important to us. And you revere the figures about whom you write. And it's actually, you know, anyone who reads your book will understand why you revere them, because they're the people that, you know, you want to succeed. they're the ones that you hope will triumph, particularly when you think about the context of the immediate aftermath of defeat in 1945 in Germany and the immediate aftermath of Nazism and the Holocaust. You want these people to win. But I guess what I think would be very interesting to hear you say then, in light of your last comments, is of the sort of collection of engaged Democrats, who really for you is, or what are the small handful of people who for you are the real or particular heroes of yours? I mean, if I can ask the question that way, it's not a customary question for us to ask, I guess, of other historians, but I think it's a fair enough question when we were talking about, you know, our own sort of principles and commitments as historians. Are there people that really for you were particularly compelling? Maybe I'll say it that way, and whose life stories or whose ideas for you were particularly meaningful?
What a fascinating question. I'm trying to figure out if I were to pick favorites, how I would do it. I do think it's a great opportunity. Of course, I should tell your listeners a little bit more concretely who the cast of characters is here. I'm not sure that I would want to pick favorites or and of course you're picking up on things that I said, but I don't know that I revere so much as appreciate them individually and each of their, you know, in some respects very you know, heroic in a kind of in a kind of classical sense, but in very, very few cases, and most much more prosaic and much more common and full of the sorts of twists, turns, and foibles that all of our lives are full of in in much less challenging circumstances in many respects. But I guess what I really appreciate about all of them and about the way that they fit together is how they're views on democracy and democratic renewal tended in the direction of proposing a kind of counter-elitist, a kind of bottom-up set of approaches to the whole topic of how one might organize politics and society in a way that broke with many kinds of long-standing traditions of, modern European traditions about thinking about politics that really foregrounded the people, their active agency, and their the potentials, the democratic potentials that come out of their self-organization in that moment. And I'm not sure that that's anything that I would want to cohere in any, that's something that they all share together, as opposed to something that I want to laud any one of them in particular for.
No, I get that.
But I mean, these are this is an incredible mix of folks. They come out of incredibly broad mix of actors. They come out of a range of interwar and wartime sorts of backgrounds and milieus. The network that I analyze that links them, a loose network, both ideologically and socially, but it crosses the bounds of Catholic, in this case, left Catholic, and other sorts of religious milieus, of liberal, sort of more middle of the road figures, of people that were involved on the left and actively politicized on the left for a long time, as well as people that were unpolitical until 1945 and were, in a sense, energized by that moment to develop a political persona that they didn't have before. You know, one of the figures that leaps to mind, certainly one of the more one of the more powerful stories, one of the few that actually was a kind of active resistor during the war. There were many, but no one as high profile as Eugen Kogon, for instance, a kind of champion of left Catholicism, of the sorts of ideas that I talk about in my book, about decentralized, bottom-up, grassroots kinds of political arrangements and economic arrangements. One of the figures that co-found this journal, the Frankfurter Hefte, in the years right after the war, with his colleague Walter Jokes and some other people, and he was imprisoned. He was arrested by the Nazis in Austria after the annexation in 1938, and spent the following 6.5 years in Nazi custody in various locations. But the bulk of that was in Buchenwald, actually, and he was involved with the camp resistance there. And he came out. He survived. He was in a privileged sort of position, actually. One of these folks that had a special kind of role to play in the camp that allowed him to that he had a relatively easy time of it. In fact, so much so that he even read the Frankfurter Zeitung at times, and kind of discovered his post-war colleague Walter Jokes' writings in the Frankfurter Zeitung before it was shut down. But he was very involved with the camp resistance there. And, you know, there's this sort of adventurous story about how he's, as liberation is in the spring of 45 and liberation is almost upon Buchenwald, and he's sort of smuggled out of the camp by the camp resistance and to make contact with the advancing American troops in this case, and also to contact the camp administration to try to keep them from liquidating the camp, in advance of the approaching troops in some sort of way that would exacerbate the suffering and endanger the remaining inmates. So it's this incredibly adventurous story, and he's a very compelling figure, and he goes on to write this very important book, The SS State, and to become a political science professor. And he plays a very central role. Again, one of those 10 or 15 actors that are very much in the middle of my narrative, or at a very important sort of node of this network. But he himself had a checkered past. He was in the 1920s, not on the left side of political Catholicism, where he'll end up after the war with Walter Jokes very, very prominently, but very much on the right. He was a student of a kind of sociologist and political scientist before these disciplines specialized as much as they have today. In the 1920s, studying with Otmar Spahn in Vienna, and this very kind of clerico-conservative, Spahn is well known for his theory of the corporatist state, which played an important role in Austro, in the kind of clerical, the right-leaning clerical, so-called Austro-fascist sorts of you know, regimes that had held power in Austria in the 30s. And, you know, that's kind of Kogon's background, right? So he's to sort of revere or to heroize that wouldn't be my objective so much as to historicize and to marvel at the transformation that he undergoes.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's fascinating. I mean, I think that the when you refer to the foibles, you know, of an individual human life or the complex paths that people's lives can take, particularly under the conditions, the political conditions that faced the individuals about whom you write, that's a very, very interesting part of your book, I think. I wonder if you could tell us if we can move into the realm a little bit less. Speak a little bit less about biography now and maybe move into the realm of ideas themselves. And maybe just as a general question to start thinking about what the Engaged Democrats' prescriptions actually were for the creation of a democratic and post-fascist, obviously, Germany. I wonder if you could start us off with talking about that a little bit.
Certainly. The prescriptions, in terms of kind of concrete institutional programs or prescriptions, they varied very dramatically. And in fact, many of them weren't that interested in institutions per se. That is, didn't have crystalline proposals or well-worked out sorts of blueprints for what German society should look like. You know, the common threads that linked them had more to do with these sorts of principles. You know, the various kinds of institutional proposals all involved a kind of focus on participation, on political participation. I've mentioned it already, as a kind of political good in and of itself, as the core of an active democratic life, an active collective existence, but also as a means to self education or to a kind of self re-education. I mean, one of the things that that distinguished these all these various programs was a focus on this sense of practicing democratic engagement as both the end state that they're trying to propose and as the means of getting to a kind of inner democratization, the development of these, you know, ultimately post-fascist and post-Nazi Germans into Democrats, yeah, as it were, and they were quite consistent on in the claim that really the only way for that kind of development to happen, that kind of transformation to happen, to make Democrats of former fascists, was through the practice of actually engaging in self-rule through a whole myriad of institutions. Right, so participation was a kind of means and end in this process. The most well worked out proposals came from circles around cultural political journals. Most of these engaged Democrats were involved in founding journals of one sort or another in this period, the sort of the main venue of their activity in Frankfurt, so Frankfurt am Main, and in Heidelberg. These had very well worked out proposals with a lot of overlap between the two that that haven't really been foregrounded in previous scholarship. So politically, you know, they worked very much in a kind of parliamentary frame, but they were skeptical of parties, especially of mass parties, or organized around interest and ideology, as opposed to groups of these active citizens that would come together and debate the public good. So in a parliamentary frame, but emphasizing self-government at all possible levels, so organs of local self-government, the principle of federalism, mm-hmm, of devolving competencies from the center to lower levels, a kind of federalist decentralization was very important to them. So parliamentary, but local self-government, federalist principles as a sort of means to maximize this crucial activity of self-government and the self-educative or pedagogical potentials that it held. And that's just on the political side. You know, in economics, the vast majority of the figures in this network were democratic socialists of one of one sort or another. Mm-hmm. Certainly, in the case of the Frankfurt Circle, Kogon and Dirksen, their Frankfurter Hefte, or in Heidelberg, I mentioned around, in a loose sense, the journal Die Wandlung, but with all sorts of ancillary kinds of activities that this circle pursued. And there, the two of the members of that node of the network, Alfred Weber, actually the brother of the much better known sociologist Max Weber, but also a sociologist himself, and Alexander Michalich, who, you know, was relatively was completely unknown at the time. Weber was older and already a prominent scholar, but Michalich, of course, would go on to have a very important public career. And they put together a proposal called Free Socialism, Freier Sozialismus, in 1946, that really served as a kind of to crystallize a lot of the programmatic proposals that came out of Heidelberg. And they are also the kinds of politics that I talked about in the Frankfurt case held. But in economics, there are all sorts of proposals for decentralized modes of socialism, decentralized collective modes of ownership that aren't state socialist, collective forms of ownership that aren't state socialist, so socialized as opposed to nationalized property, and a really strong emphasis that was actually probably stronger on the Frankfurt side than in Heidelberg on principles of self-management and self-government in the economy. Mm-hmm. So the principle of co-determination, of Mitbestimmung, was very, very important to them. Different ways that working people, the workers themselves, can be involved in the control of and the decision-making processes involved in, in running their firms, in running these firms that are also reorganized at the level of ownership in a myriad of socialized kinds of formats. Right? So federalism, party decentered parliamentarism. None of them actively advocated, only in a few of them in select moments actively advocate parliamentarism's sort of radical alternative of council democracy that cropped up at various points during the 20th century, during the first half of the 20th century, most importantly after World War I. But that was part of their politics. Council democracy had shared this affinity for grassroots kinds of forms, and they had a great deal of interest in that, although their proposals tended to be parliamentary. And then, as I said, kind of analogs to councils in the economic world, everything from works councils on the shop floor to worker participation in various kinds of organs of the governance of firms and decision making within firms that fall under the heading of co-determination, and that are actually elements of a longer term social democratic and social democratic council communist left socialist sorts of principles that they highlighted.
Yeah, very interesting. I was just thinking about, it's an aside, but it still strikes me that here recently where I live in the eastern part of Tennessee, there was it was put before the workers of there's a local not very near where I live, but not too far from here either, the Volkswagen plant put it to the workers to have a kind of Mitbestimmung, a kind of co-determining body created in the plant, and it was voted down, which is kind of an interesting thing because of the older history that you're describing and the very different way that labor is organized in Germany, which has to do with some of the things some of the ideas that you're talking about over the longer term.
It does very much. And yeah. The Chattanooga plant story is one that I've been following, the Volkswagen plant there. And it is really interesting, but it points to ways in which these principles and Mitbestimmung is a very important one, sort of corporatist principles and principles of what went under the rubric of economic democracy and sort of, you know, in the social democratic traditions that were interested in this. You know, in this moment in 1945, when so many things seemed possible, opened up as really, really radical sorts of proposals for a structurally different society, as it were. And a lot of them have a kind of reformist or accommodationist ring now in labor politics. You know, they're tied very much to a kind of set of settlements that were forged in the 1950s, right? Where then co-determination is just co-determination, right? Labor gets to have a say. Big labor, you know, organized in unions, or actually in the majority of the economy, unions, direct influence was very circumscribed. But you know, workers, the community of the shop, the Betriebsgemeinschaft, you know, could have a say, but a very limited one, right? They get a word in here and there. And these principles of co-determination as kind of grassroots democratic principles in the debates of the immediate post-war years, they had a kind of structurally much more expansive and I guess politically much more ambitious sorts of projects that were worked out in that kind of framework.
How do you, maybe you could say something about this. I hadn't planned to ask you this either, but now that you're talking about these very concrete sorts of proposals for real, really what would have been, and some of which turned out to be quite thoroughgoing changes. I mean, the changes that were implemented, quite thoroughgoing and changes that had an enormous impact on the development, on the, I would think, I mean, I do think, on the later development of German democracy. But I wonder if you could talk, maybe you could say something about, so you have, on the one hand, you have kind of looked at your group of individuals, your engaged Democrats, as a network. And that's a very important kind of concept in your book, not to see them so much as individuals, but to see them as a part of a greater group of people who are engaged in very similar ways of thinking about solving common problems. And they're very focused on the notion of participation and the practice of participation. And you've already outlined some of the very interesting proposals that they had, concrete ones for how people would learn to participate democratically. I wonder, though, if you could give some examples of how. So you have, on the one hand, your network, and the network is in conversation with itself, with its various constituent members. In what ways, then, do the engaged Democrats also talk to people who are not in the network, people who are coal miners, for example? You have a fantastic photograph in your book of I think it's Kogon meeting with coal miners. I wonder if you could talk about that just a little bit, and how what engaged Democrats were talking about doing, then how it gets heard beyond the network, I guess I would say.
The project of communicating with a broader public was absolutely central to what they were up to, both in the immediate post-war years and afterward. So in the immediate post-war years, you know, this kind of loose and variegated but consistent and connected in ways that I try to show network is both talking to itself, right, and even far-flung nodes of the network that I've talked about that I haven't talked about. I mean, I'm folks in East Berlin and people that will, after the split, affiliate with and identify with who are in the Soviet zone and will become important in the GDR. I mean, their questions of federalism and decentralization played rather differently, right? Yes. But they shared these same impulses about participation, about publicness, you know, the publicness as a kind of principle of politics, worked themselves out somewhat differently in terms of concrete proposals. But so the network itself was differentiated and variegated enough, but they definitely engaged in direct dialogue with other groupings on the kind of intellectual scene in immediate post-war Germany. The Allied powers, of course, first and foremost, kind of setting the framework for their activity. And then other really important German intellectual political sorts of groupings, people that with the engaged Democrats, one of the sorts of commonalities with their politics was advocating for an independent, so-called neutralist, an actively neutral kind of German future that would be between the not affiliated directly with these sort of incipiently polarizing superpowers and the and their allies. There were groups on the ground in Germany that were advocating, you know, closer ties to the East or closer ties to the West, and privileging the sorts of proposals that or the sorts of futures that those that the United States or France or Britain on the one hand, and that the Soviet Union and the so-called the budding so-called folks people's democracies of Eastern Europe represented. That was some kind of axis of distinction in which the engaged Democrats, Germany's engaged Democrats, sort of dialogued with other German groups on the ground, with more conservative groups, a very prominent voice in the immediate post-war years. Those who talked about Germany as participating in a kind of Occidental political and cultural formation of Europe as an Abendland, and it had a very conservative kind of inflection, seeing secularism and the materialism that for that matter both the post-war West and the Soviet Union represented as foils against which a Christian Europe would distinguish itself. So there are dialogue partners on the ground in this immediate post-war moment, but they're also Germany's engaged Democrats were also very interested in forming coalitions outside of the intellectual sphere itself. So in the immediate post-war years, this plays itself out in various kinds of pursuits that transcended the realm of founding and writing in these journals, various kinds of other organizational pursuits, various kinds of other groups that they attempted to form and to direct or to see on their way into the broader sphere of politics. And then the picture that you mentioned about Eugen Kogon, on whom we've already focused a bit, and these coal miners actually points to some of the coalition building that they tried to execute in the immediate post-war years. You know, the idea of bringing Christians and workers together was very, very central for these for Kogon and Derrickson, the circle around the Frankfurter Hefte. But by the 1950s, when their initial hopes for a kind of radically renewed Germany, you know, democratic, socialist, independent of the occupying powers, and independent of the Cold War, had in a sense been stymied, had run aground on the realities of the Cold War and the division of Germany. People that were in the West, as Kogon and Dirks were, sought new kinds of partnerships, new kinds of coalitions. And there they teamed up quite directly with the unions, who were important in these struggles for Mitbestimmung, for co-determination, as the various kinds of more emphatic forms of co-determination get kind of whittled down and shaped into what will be the post-war settlement that you mentioned in the context of VW in Tennessee a little bit earlier. And that photo is a wonderful sort of artifact of this moment where, for your listeners, Eugen Kogon is, he's there in his double-breasted suit. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a little bit threadbare, but he's in one of these, mines at a festival, the so-called Ruhr Festival, a kind of cultural festival that the Union Federation in West Germany put on for the workers in this very important coal mining district in the Ruhr, in a city called Recklinghausen, and he's there in his double-breasted suit, and he's surrounded by, I think there are two or three coal miners in frame, with of course the dust on their faces and their eyes exposed, and it's really not entirely clear who is communicating what to whom.
That's
in
right.
That photo. It's really pretty remarkable, but. It's an event that I go into a little bit in just the one of the late chapters of the book, where you have the unions mobilizing intellectuals to talk about the state of the labor constitution, as they called it, of West Germany, and the possibilities for a union-oriented politics. And this is something that Kogler and Dirks and all sorts of other people in West Germany took very, very seriously, and the unions as a kind of coalition partner in trying to forge a politics that would, that would fight against the restoration, a term that they coined, but the sort of conservatively inflected restoration of older modes of doing just about anything,
right.
That they confronted in West Germany. And, this produced at the level of connections between intellectuals and politicians, a peace movement in the mid-1950s that was the first broad-based extra-parliamentary mobilization in West Germany, and has very concrete sorts of ties to other modes and moments of political activism in the 1960s and relating to the New Left. So, this coalition between intellectuals and the unions was very productive and very powerful in many ways, but the photo that you mentioned references this moment, other aspects of that kind of connection, where you have these very, very two very, very different worlds that have to meet and talk to one another in the context of forging that kind of a coalition. And really one of the workers is smiling at the camera and clearly not listening to whatever Eugen Kogan must be saying at all. And it really...
Either that or that guy just told a joke and Eugen Kogan is trying to figure out what he meant.
That may also be, absolutely. But it's a funny moment of slippage in that attempted coalition building there.
Yeah, no, it is, absolutely. I thought it was a very striking moment in the book. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about history, because I think that's for me, that was a really interesting... that was a very interesting part of your book, was sort of how these individuals, how the engaged Democrats dealt with the problem of the past. And so you're alluding to it, actually, when you talk about the concept of restoration. I mean, there was a fear, which is a quite legitimate fear, that that somehow things would just kind of go back to the way they had been before. And, with minor amendments, we can, we won't have a dictatorship anymore, but a lot of other things will structurally stay the same. And these engaged Democrats were very concerned about that possibility. And so there's another way in which history is important in your book, a related way, which is the question of what to do about these sort of foundational concepts that are so important to sort of the furtherance of German culture and society in a certain sense. I mean, ideas about culture and about the meaning of culture in German history, ideas about what Germans called Bildung. I mean, the term Bildung is still used, certainly, but it has a very different meaning now than it had in 1945. This notion of sort of self-cultivation and those ideas, of course, after 1945, like everything else in Germany, had to be called into question. And so, how do you, and this is what I'm trying to ask you, it's just taking me a long time to get there, how do you, on the one hand, try to forge a path forward to do something new, but of course you have to work with what you have. So how do the engaged Democrats deal with these older concepts that are so foundational in German cultural life over centuries, actually?
Well, Monica, you point to a really core aspect of what's fascinating about these figures that I highlight, and that is the insistence with which, and this is another kind of principle of delineating the network, as I was looking into who was saying what on the ground right after the war, the insistence with which this set of actors, who, you know, not accidentally then, were in communication with one another, you know, talking to one another on this field of cultural political debate, the insistence with which they intertwined thinking about politics in the ways that we've talked about, all right, you know, politics and economics, with thinking about culture was really quite striking. And there was really no way to separate these themes in confronting this period, because other actors didn't. Right.
I mean,
other folks on whom I don't focus might have been engaged in questions of culture and its renewal, or rather its rehabilitation, or might have been, you know, there was plenty of dialogue about politics and economics that I don't focus on that didn't, you know, in the same venues and oftentimes in the same articles or even the same sentences, sort of intertwine questions about culture with questions about politics in the way that that Germany's engaged Democrats did. One of the aspects of this issue is points to this idea of renewal. So the renewal half of democratic renewal, and a really clear sense of the temporality of 1945, of this moment of rupture, right? The zero hour, a problematic notion that that at the level of their personal experience, they took extremely seriously, of 1945 and the end of National Socialism and the end of the war and the defeat of this Nazi version of Germany as a kind of moment for the possibility of a radically different future. But their commitment to the idea that involved neither a kind of rehabilitation of past traditions, you know, something that they grouped under the heading of restoration, which has a whole other life subsequently, or a related life. It's developed from their discussions of it into, in a narrower sort of way, a general accusation of the cultural and political left in West Germany about the illegitimacy of that state's foundation. But this sense that you couldn't just rehabilitate old traditions, so the traditions of German culture that you mentioned, but also other sorts of political and economic stances and traditions. But you didn't want to reject them either, that moving forward in Germany involved a kind of critical reappropriation of these deeply ambivalent in and of themselves aspects of the German past. So not that there were sort of good parts and bad parts, but the good and the bad were so deeply intertwined for them that critically reappropriating, refashioning in a new context these traditions was the mode in which they would talk about what renewal meant.
Yeah.
Right? And the specific traditions that you asked about the cultural heritage, these figures of, you know, German, the flowering of classical German culture from the late 18th through the early part of the 19th century, Goethe and Schiller and Lessing, from Kant over Fichte and Schelling to Hegel and philosophy and all sorts of other figures to the radicals of the 1830s and 40s, Heinrich Heine and Karl Marx for that matter, were all seen as a kind of body of resources on which one might draw, but that were also bound up with a set of traditions or a set of habits that they both shaped and reflected, that were complicit in a sense in the terrible trajectory that German history had taken. So, when it comes to idealist philosophy, so Kant to Hegel or Romanticism and neoclassicism literature, the sort of Goethe Schiller camp, these engaged Democrats were very, very conscious of how a fascination with that German culture and the modes of, as you said, self-cultivation and self-development and the development of individual capacities had been rendered almost exclusively in a kind of intellectualized way, in an otherworldly way, in a way that privileged this realm of culture over the world.
Right.
Over an engagement in politics, in economics, a kind of apoliticism or a worldly sort of quietism that developed out of that engaged Democrats and other people, other kinds of critics after 1945, saw as wrapped up in the historical dynamics that produced then Nazism and its crimes, that a kind of inability of German people to focus concretely on the political world made them susceptible to national nationalist politics, to a kind of a set of authoritarian complexes,
right,
that that enabled the rise of militarism, of nationalism, and of national socialism as a kind of outgrowth of that. Right? But where these engaged Democrats differed from other folks that were talking about the cultural tradition was not only in the fact that they critiqued this tradition, unlike many people, a more conservative and by far the dominant position in the post-war period involved a kind of uncritical affirmation of these aspects. Right, that we could,
right, as though they were they had somehow remained impervious to Nazism, to what had happened.
Yes, exactly. That these traditions had nothing to do with Nazism and could be a kind of could be simply returned to in the sense that you could go home to Goethe, as one of the sort of key words, key phrases in the period was. Coined by Frank Thies, who actually, who's also well known for criticizing Thomas Mann in the great debate between exiles and so-called inner emigres. Thies spoke up for the folks that had stayed in Germany, and his position was that there were these shining German cultural traditions that Nazism had just Nazism had kind of grafted its own values over, and that Germans could simply scrape away that Nazi scourge and return to these positive cultural traditions. Right, so that was another position that the Germany's engaged Democrats distinguished themselves from on the cultural field of conversations about renewal. They critiqued the cultural tradition in the ways that I mentioned, but they also saw it as a kind of as this really robust and potentially quite transformative resource for democratic renewal in the post-war years. That philosophy from Kant to Hegel and the literature of Goethe and Schiller and this has certain kinds of resonances already in the 1830s and 40s with people like Heine and Marx, focused on or boiled down to a kind of core principle of a specific way of viewing the human subject and subjectivity and human freedom, as self-developing and world-shaping simultaneously. And this kind of core principle or core trope of an autonomous, of a self-legislating, making its own rules, both self-developing and shaping its own world, sort of vision of the human subject from German literature and German philosophy, could be in a sense that potential could be recovered from this apolitical kind of set of outcomes that it generated in or was that it abetted in actual German history and brought to bear as the kind of core principle of this new participatory politics after the catastrophe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Very
so in that sense, this ambiguous relationship to the German cultural tradition, to everything that that Bildung and that Geistkultur and Bildung stood for in the German 19th century, ways that the educated middle classes had of distinguishing themselves from the masses and of keeping themselves separate from and above the profane world of politics and economics with their sort of Mandarin fixation on matters cultural, and was both a kind of symptom of everything that had gone wrong in German history for Germany's engaged Democrats, and a sort of resource that could be broken out of that framework and redeployed in a political kind of context as a fundamental aspect of what the subjectivity behind this participatory vision of politics that they developed was about.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very interesting. That's hearing you put it together again actually gave me a kind of a different take or another angle on the book that I had not quite put together for myself as of yet. So I think that's really interesting, and I'm glad we got you to talk about that a little bit, about the relationship between culture and politics very specifically. I wonder if, towards the end of your book, you have a chapter. It may actually be the epilogue, but I don't think so. I think it's just the last chapter of the book, but you'll correct me if I'm wrong, which is about what a lot of people would say, I think you would say, was the sort of the apotheosis of participatory democracy in the 20th century, which are the moments in 1968 all over the world, and then again in 1989. And you have this really interesting chapter where you sort of talk about the extent to which we can see in these moments in 1968 and 1989, we can, especially in 68, we can actually still see the engaged Democrats at work in various ways. And that's a very interesting story. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit too about whether or not, I mean, is it right to see in that apotheosis of participatory democracy in West Germany and then in East Germany too in 1989, is it right to see that as a part of the legacy of the engaged Democrats? What do you think about that?
I think that that is one of the sorts of outcomes that I want to that I do think the engaged Democrats had something to do with. Right. I mean, I certainly do think that we can see this as a kind of legacy. I do think that it's much clearer, as you've already sort of gestured at, in the case of 1968, or all the developments that kind of stands in for.
Right.
Then in the case of 1989, it's much more attenuated in the sorts of developments leading up to the popular revolutionary side of the end of the East German regime in 1989. One way into this is to think about how the central actors of 1968, so the movements of 1968, everything from the students to the unions to the churches, the new left as a whole, the kind of peace movement, so unions and churches, and the 1950s peace movement, the students, the SDS, so the Socialist German Students League, the mobilizations against the emergency laws, another crucial kind of ingredient to 1968 in West Germany, really picked up on something that we haven't gotten as much of a chance to talk about, what the engaged Democrats were at the center of in the 1950s in terms of their own activities, right? This critique of the Restoration, the critique of, in more detail, what they called re-Nazification, a kind of sense of this, of a failed reckoning with the Nazi past, and both at the level of kind of personnel continuities in the state and at the level of people's own individual conscience, the remilitarization, what the peace movement had been against, restoration, remilitarization, renazification. These are all tropes that ideas about West Germany that the movements of 1968 picked up on very, very clearly. And as I argue in the book, the engaged Democrats were crucial at sort of forging that language, right? They also, as you mentioned, played a role themselves. I mean, they were present in these different facets institutionally of the New Left and of the movements of 1968 themselves. But in a sense, their rhetorical reservoir was also really important that they had generated in these oppositional stances in the 1950s for shaping the politics of 1968. And there were, of course, many distinctions as well. The 68ers per se, of course, had a much broader kind of frame for their for their politics and their interests. I mean, everything from their protest forms to the lifestyle politics and the kinds of cultural and 1968 is a kind of cultural revolution that these, you know, that these the engaged Democrats of an older generation and still in terms of their kind of comportment and their habitus and their personas, very much Bildungsbürger kind of, you know, many of them were, you know, these aspects of 1968 didn't even show up on their radar screen.
Right.
But in terms of the thinking, this emphasis on participation, the kind of orientation to all German initiatives and a vision of German neutrality as a kind of way of breaking apart and undermining the Cold War. You know, I try to work some of those connections out with reference to Rudi Dutschke and his politics, this vision that he elaborated of West Berlin as a kind of council republic that,
yeah.
You know, whose influence could spread, reunify East and West Germany. Dutschke, of course, had been an East German in time to see the great oppositional sort of high point, such as it was, of the engaged Democrats in East Germany, which is a story of about 1956 and about using the seeing in the moment of de-Stalinization both an opportunity to reckon with their sort of fractured affinities for and to some extent illusions about the potential of the GDR as a socialist dictatorship that, you know, that for reasons of its sort of anti-fascist credentials, these engaged Democrats that that affiliated after 1949 with the East, as it was called, you know, slowly sort of lost their enthusiasm for and developed increasingly oppositional sorts of ideas about. And these really broke open in 1956, and Dutschke was there to see it and goes to West Germany later and is very important in 1968. And Ernst Bloch, one of the central engaged Democrats, and Wolfgang Harich, another one, Bloch goes west as well, and Hans Meyer goes west as well. Wolfgang Harich stays, but these are all people that were involved in various kinds of initiatives around 1956. And the story about 1989 is a much more distant one because, by and large, there isn't really direct direct involvement by these people that are at the core of the story of my book in the events of 1989. But the, you know, if we want to say 1989ers in sort of analog to the 68ers, we're very conscious of these prior moments of destabilization in the system and of democratic critique, and 1956 was one of those moments. I mean, there are other figures in between. You know, Wolf Biermann, very crucial to the sort of story of dissent and opposition, popular mobilization in the 1980s, in terms of, you know, intellectual figureheads at least, that has really very little to do with the story. But Stefan Heim, for instance, does in some interesting sorts of ways. You know, Stefan Heim, alongside Christa Wolf, probably two of the most prominent intellectual opposition figures in the early parts of the revolution of 1989. The mobilizations and culminated in October and in November of that year. And Stefan Heim's story sort of intertwines with that of the engaged Democrats. He does come back to Germany too late to be one. I mean, another way in which these engaged Democrats are distinctive are they really, the network that I talk about was on the ground to take shape in the years right after the war, 45 to 48 or 49. And, you know, intellectuals who and political figures who may very well have been both engaged and democratic, but just weren't in immediate post-war Germany, in that sense, fall out of my frame. And Heim is one of those people. He comes back in 51 to the GDR. He had been in exile, as some of the engaged Democrats were, in his case, in the U.S., and he came back briefly in 1945 with the occupation troops and then goes back. But he falls prey to the kind of McCarthy-era anti-communism. Mm-hmm. And relocates then to the GDR, and has a complicated history of of affinity and opposition in the 50s and the 60s. By the 80s, he becomes central to what will develop there. And he's, as I said, one of the most high profile figures in 89. So he's kind of had glancing intersections with these engaged Democrats. The way that their biographies kind of meet up at moments. But it's really interesting from the late 70s through the early 80s in his own literary production, as he begins to imagine, he writes these political novels that kind of reproduce the history of the activism in which the engaged Democrats were really quite directly involved. And he works them up in this literary way, writing the novel Colleen in the late 1970s, which very explicitly reworks this material from 1956 and the possibility of a kind of internal democratic critique of the GDR, of a kind of socialist democratization of the GDR that Wolfgang Harrich was very central to. He works this up in this novel about the emergence and the crushing of that. Of that possibility in 1956. And then a few years later, he writes his novel Schwarzenberg about the so-called unoccupied, the Schwarzenberg Republic in this unoccupied corner of the of what will become East Germany when the Allies just didn't quite get there to that corner of the mountains in 1945. And there are all kinds of, certainly to an extent mythologized and romanticized sorts of ideas about this moment of German self-government and in 1945 what might have happened if these grassroots nuclei of kind of anti-fascists that are able to flourish as the regime is crumbling, what would have happened if they took power? So Heim's kind of literary production then in the 1980s sort of culminates in a moment that, having looked at 1956, he then looks at 1945 as a kind of resource for the democratization of the GDR, the socialist democratization that he's hoping for in 1989, and referencing thereby these crucial moments of the activity, the activism, and the intellectual production of the figures that I talk about in my book. So again, much more attenuated connections, right? Some of the figures that are purged and discredited in 56 are rehabilitated in 1989 and 1990. Walter Janka, a couple of the other protagonists around or related to Wolfgang Harrich. And Harrich himself is rehabilitated, but not with the public fanfare of these other figures and a kind of conflict between Wolfgang Harrich and Walter Janka about whether or not Janka was involved in these discussions that culminated in a platform for the radical restructuring of the GDR in 1956 that Harrich wrote, and then very much on his own initiative and without anyone else noticing, communicated to the to the much despised sort of spy arm for the East, the East Bureau, the Ostbüro, of the Social Democratic Party in West Germany. There's a kind of conflict that erupts in the wake of 1989 between Harrich and Janka about that history of 1956 and 19 that culminated in show trials for both of them in 1957 and in both of their arrests and imprisonment. That's also a very bitter sort of legacy of the engaged Democrats that gets worked out in the years in and around 1989.
That's right. I think you've given us some really good pathways, I would say, into understanding the project of the book as a whole, and I appreciate that very much, and I know that our listeners will appreciate it. There's a lot there, and we could keep talking for hours about your book. There's a lot of things that we couldn't get to, but I think we've taken up probably too much of your time already. And though I appreciate that very much, I do wonder if you would indulge me just for another minute or two and kind of maybe tell our listeners what sorts of projects or what kind of a book you're working on now or, you know, anything like that. I mean, sort of give us a sense of what Sean Forner's up to right now.
Aside from teaching, obviously, my current, my new research project, it's a new book project. It's still kind of, it's very much information, but it explores the transformation of socialist politics and theory in 1950s Europe. So Germany, very much in East and West Europe in this context, a transformation that we can recognize retrospectively as the work of an intellectual first new left, right? Mm. So it builds on some of the themes that we've talked about, but very much in a comparative and transnational kind of form frame, with a different sort of focus, a different set of actors, a different set of questions. So the first new left, when these diverse groups of intellectuals across Europe gathering to express their rejection of the Cold War world, but also to revitalize socialism in what they called a humanist vein. This is very much the intellectual political configuration that generates socialist humanism. Turning away from the established leftist parties, turning away from the Marxist and socialist left's commitment to objective laws and historical necessity as principles, turning toward subjectivity, consciousness, praxis as foci of socialist thinking, and away from the parties and what they see as compromised social democratic and communist political traditions in terms of actual mobilization.
That sounds really interesting. I mean, so in a sense, taking some of the core themes of your book and then expanding that outward into Europe as a whole and sort of looking at different actors, probably some of your same actors will show up, I would assume, again in the second book. But I think that sounds like a really wonderful sort of progression from this book to the next one.
Yeah, no, it's very handy. There are a couple of actors that overlap, but it's really a couple of case studies that I expand on. Actually, one is the moment that we talked about so much partway through these intellectual conversations between unions and intellectuals. But treating that in the 1950s with the photo of Kogan and the miners, treating that as a Western European forum for discussion, and that was a moment where a lot of these trends that I'll argue in the new book reshaped socialism and built the groundwork for an intellectual new left and a first new left of the 1950s took shape. There's also a philosophy conference in 1956 in Eastern Europe that drew folks in East Berlin, that drew folks from all over Eastern Europe and all over and places in Western Europe too, that I'll look at as another kind of case study of what they called revisionist Marxist thinking in Eastern Europe, but in a way that was very much bound up with developments, again, outside of Germany in Poland, in Hungary, in Czechoslovakia, but also case studies that have nothing to do with the material that we've talked about. Three interrelated journals in Milan and Paris and West Berlin that cropped up in the mid 1950s, all kind of looking at each other and in dialogue with one another as fora for working out this kind of humanized socialism that drew on both older kinds of leftist and non-leftist traditions. The most famous site of this first new left, of course, is the one that gave the first new left its name, was the British group around the New Left Review, and the two journals that came together, two late 50s journals that came together to form that in 1960s, and they had various sorts of really interesting connections to Yugoslavia, actually, to Poland as well in 1956-57. I imagine another chapter that focuses on those sorts of connections. And I'm really interested in how these kinds of translocal and cross-border contracts were relevant to these groups of intellectuals coming together and thinking about transforming socialism in this kind of way. But I'm also very interested in what made similar ideas plausible at the same time, but in different places, in the East as well as the Western Europe. And so methodologically, I'm interested in thinking about broader frames of socio-political and socio-economic context that might help us make sense of why these kinds of ideas, both the rejection of certain aspects of the, you know, what they would then call the old left of mainstream social democracy and mainstream communism, but also the attraction of these new ideas about consciousness, about subjectivity, about disciplinary techniques and surveillances and spectacles. You know, what about the kind of 1950s world, this high modernist world in both East and West Europe, in terms of the socioeconomic context, not just in terms of the cultural and intellectual context and the sociopolitical context, made those kinds of ideas attractive and might explain why they took root in different places that didn't necessarily have any contact or communication with one another in the same historical moment.
That's right. That's fascinating. That's going to be a wonderful book, I have to say. I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I do want to take this just one moment to thank you and just to let you know how much I enjoyed hearing you talk about your new book. The book is called German Intellectuals and the Challenge of Democratic Renewal, Culture and Politics After 1945. Actually, I enjoyed hearing you talk about that, and I enjoyed equally hearing you talk about your new project. The author is Sean Forner. We've been talking to Sean about his new book, published by Cambridge very recently. Sean, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Monica, it's been a great pleasure for me too. Thank you.